TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Amira Haas, Thoughts About Suicide Bombers and Their Families. Amira Haas is the only Jewish-Israeli correspondent on Palestinian affairs who is living among the people she reports on. When an Israeli tank recently pulled up in front of her apartment in Ramallah, she decided not to use her privilege as an Israeli to protect herself. Instead, she made her escape through the back door. Amira Haas is the daughter of Holocaust survivors and a writer for the large daily newspaper Haaretz. By the end of 1993, she had moved to the occupied Gaza Strip and reported on daily news from there. In 1997, she made the very brave move to Ramallah, where she still lives today. Her features and op-ed pieces are disseminated widely in the international press. Her most recent book is a collection of articles. Reporting from Ramallah, an Israeli journalist in an occupied land. Amira Haas spoke at the University of California, Berkeley in October 2003. The Center for Middle Eastern Studies had invited her for her talk about suicide bombers and their families. Amira Haas received a standing ovation.
Thanks. I've chosen this very difficult emotional subject of suicide bombers and their immediate surrounding and their organizational background because it has become a phenomenon that we cannot disregard. Of course, no Israeli disregards this. Many Israelis think it's the focus of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict now. Many people in the world believe that this is the reason for the conflict. Well, let's all put off all the mobiles now. I thought it was only an Israeli-Palestinian disease. So in the course of the coming hour, I'll be able to at least show my reason to think and to believe that this is not the cause of the conflict and of the problems, but still we have to relate to it very carefully because it certainly is a phenomenon. And as just a week ago, an acquaintance of mine in Nablus said that one needs only 5 minutes in order to convince a Palestinian youngster to go and commit a suicide attack against Israelis. So this phenomenon needs our attention. Now I find myself also in a very, as somebody who wants to understand this phenomenon, I find myself in a difficult situation because I don't trust the reports of the Israeli Shabak, of the Israeli intelligence. Not because they are not accurate. They are full of details, family details, background, organizational background, all such things that sometimes miss from Palestinian reports. But when an intelligence agent goes and examines or even talks to would-be suicide bombers who were caught on time, I don't believe he or she, these agents, are able to really to grasp this phenomenon. They are too much drowned into the vocabulary and narrative and understanding of a victimized Israeli society, and they don't see at all their position as occupiers. So this is one part which I cannot rely on, one source of information which I cannot rely on. Another source of information which, on which I cannot rely are the families. Or when I go directly as a journalist with other journalists immediately after a suicide bombing to the family of a perpetrator, what I hear is that they are all behind this deed, they are all happy, they are sure that the suicide bomber is thriving now happily in heaven, etc., etc. So you hear the same hymn and the same song in every such family of all sorts of in different places in Palestinian territories, from different organizational backgrounds. You hear just the same, and I've lived long enough among Palestinians to distrust or to mistrust those speeches given to the press, which means. What I really need, and I've tried to do during the last 2 years, is to wait, always to wait, not to go immediately to a family, immediately 2 days, 3 days after the suicide attack, and to listen a lot from the nearby surrounding, from friends of mine whose relatives or nearby neighbors or friends have been involved in suicide attacks. This gives me some more, I think, perspective, some more space to the understanding of this phenomenon. In a very tragic way, I came very, very close in the last half year, very, very close to a story of suicide bombers, without choosing. I have neighbors who became friends, or actually they were friends and then neighbors, and we have strengthened our relations as friends and as friends then, who originally come from one of the villages along the now constructed separation wall or security fence or security barrier or whatever we name it. They have lost this family. I mean, their direct relatives, parents and brothers, have lost something out of the 60 dunams that they had left from 48. In 48, it was 100. Then they decided to stay on the Jordanian side of the green line because that's where they had 60% of the 60 dunams out of the 100. And now, because of this fence, which goes deep into Palestinian territory, because there is a nearby Israeli settlement called Alfei Menashe, they lost another 50 of their 60 dunams. These were the dunams, this was the space, the piece of land that my friend, my neighbor, a lawyer, defending children, he thought, oh, in time we'll build there a house for the whole family, to recreate, to bring the children from the city. His brothers, who had lost by time their jobs in Israel, they had all been workers in Israel and contractors in Israel, they had lost the jobs in the last 10 years. So they thought, okay, so we'll now recultivate the land. They paid they invested a lot of efforts, work, and money to put away the stones. It's a very rocky land, and to have their greenhouses and to plant new trees, etc. And now it's all gone. Especially one of the brothers was severely affected. I interviewed this brother, the youngest brother, about a year ago, more than a year ago. I think it was one of the first articles that were published in Israeli press about the effects of the wall, the fence. It was not clear yet where this fence will go, what it will affect. We only still saw the signs of the Israeli surveyors coming putting red crosses on greenhouses and some trees and some rocks to designate the future fence or the future upgraded green line. And he showed me, he calculated what would be lost. And then with time, we visited every 2 months, 3 months. Every 2 months, 3 months, there was another greenhouse which had to be gone. He stopped even the existing ones, he stopped cultivating or stopped taking the cucumbers or so. And then he told me, you know, and I rewrote it. He told me, you know, I don't understand how Israel thinks it's going to bring security. Because if we are losing everything, we'll be only pushed to the corner and motivated to have all kind of acts of despair. I wrote it, I published, this was the last sentence of the article, and I thought, well, if he is aware of it, he won't do this act of despair. And I knew what he meant, actually, some sort of suicide, personal, physical suicide, or family suicide, or whatever. Half a year ago, I see his brother at home in Ramallah. His face is Asian, you know, gray. And he says, my brother was arrested. At first we thought that the Israeli intelligence wanted to get out information of him about, I don't know, friends or so. And then slowly, slowly it became clear that he was involved in a suicide attack. In a way, he was driving two kids, I could say kids, from Askar refugee camp, from a refugee camp in Nablus. He was driving them to a settlement where they exploded. They managed to break some, in the explosion, to break some windows in the settlement, and they were killed. In a matter of 2 weeks, I think, he was caught. It was not difficult for the Israeli intelligence to find him. A nephew in this family was also involved, and he's wanted till today. The two suicide bombers who were killed, their houses were demolished about 2 months ago. Now the family of my neighbor's friends is actually living in permanent fear that their house will also be demolished by the Israeli authorities, by the Israeli army, because this is the habit that also when you have somebody arrested and charge sheet, still you punish before even guilt is proven by demolishing the house. And the notion, the Israeli notion, and this kind of demolitions is deterring others from doing it. We haven't really received this proof so far, because the phenomenon of suicide bombings is only expanding. Anyway, I've been witnessing this neighbor's friend's slow descent into despair. This neighbor of mine, friend of mine, just a little bit before his brother had been arrested, he started going to gym lessons, understanding that he has to take care of himself. They started to paint the house or whatever. Now he stopped everything. He cannot. His only thought at first was about his brother being interrogated. Then the other thought was about the house will be demolished, not. Then about the land which was taken, and he was angry with his brother. His brother was not young. His brother is 30, has 4 children. How come he involved himself in such an adventure, of which results? I mean, he could know. I mean, he was a bit some sane political background. He knew that Israelis are immediately finding people who are involved. What motivated him to do this act of despair and implicating an entire family, and he has 4 children and young children. This brother might spend 20 years at least in jail for his involvement. They are all aware of it, that the suicide bombings are not only inflicting disaster and trauma and death on Israeli Jews and Israelis, but on their society and families as well. And still it is a phenomenon. And still when you listen to them on official press and official reporting and television, people support it. And I know what the family really thinks, but I'm sure that if they are being interviewed, they won't dare to say what they say, what they tell me. 3 weeks ago, this neighbor friend went to see his family in the village. It took him, I think, it's a drive, it would take me 40 minutes to drive with my car in Jewish roads, which means roads that are only for Jewish traffic. and these are the main roads in the West Bank. So what would take me 40 minutes took him maybe 3-4 hours with the children in terrible village roads, rural roads, on the mountains, on rocky roads, rocky mountains, whatever. And they got back the same way from this village where they stayed one night, all coughing. Some children got almost asthmatic symptoms because the fence is being constructed just maybe 3-5 meters away from their house. Not only has it taken most of the land, but it's also just near the house. And everybody is coughing. Nothing is green. Everything is covered with dust. And permanent noise of bulldozers and orders of the contractors to their workers, etc. So the neighbor, coming very unhappy, he says, "Now I understand why my brother did it." This was 4 weeks ago. Just recently, and I think that it became very famous, the story of Hennadi Jaradat from Nablus, who blew herself up in an Israeli restaurant in Haifa. I think it was made clear by reporting all over the world, and in Israel as well, that her brother had been killed by Israeli troops while they were searching for the cousin. And so her brother was killed, and her cousin and fiancé had been killed by Israeli troops some 8 years ago. So she was clearly motivated, and she was also talking about this by revenge. But, you know, I'm a journalist, so I'm telling stories. It's not an academic, it's an academical invitation, and I'm telling stories, but I think it's important because the theories come out of the stories. Now I'll tell you something which was not written. I didn't write it to the Israeli press. She comes originally from a village called Silat al-Harthiye, northwest of Jenin. But her family has lived for many years in Jenin itself. Now, 5 of the victims of her act of revenge or despair, 5 of her victims out of 21 were Palestinian Israelis. All of them, I think, Christians, but they were all Palestinians. 2 of them come from a village in Israel, Palestinian village in Israel, called Fasuta. 2 of them are relatives of a friend of mine, a Palestinian lawyer, another Palestinian lawyer, but with an Israeli identity card. And by the way, she is a relative of the famous author Anton Shamas. So these 2 of them, 2 relatives who were killed, and this friend lawyer is working in a Palestinian NGO in defense of Palestinian prisoners in Ramallah. This NGO is called Ad-Damir. Now, another employee in this Ad-Damir NGO is a guy with the same name as the suicide bomber, Jaradat, and from the same village. They are not direct relatives. They are. They have 5 generations, maybe 5 generations back, they had a common grandfather, so they are not considered relatives. But this is another unbelievable meeting point of perpetrator and victims, and all Palestinians, and all proud Palestinians, and Palestinians who are struggling in their ways for their independence and liberation. I think it's important to know what the society says about the individual suicide bombers, how it explains this phenomenon. Before we come to the theories of Israeli intelligence agents or American intelligence agents who use the prisoners in Israel as a laboratorium for their researchers. First of all, I think most of the people are sure that those who commit suicide are not social cases, are not people in personal despair. The great majority of them. And the more the organization is religious, the more chances we have to prove that this is really so. that those who went into a suicide attack did not have bad life, personal life, in the sense they had a job, they had a career, they were not terribly poor. This is a general understanding within the society. So there is no personal motivation here. I mean, personal egotistic motivation here. Another thing which the society says regarding those suicide bombers, or another phenomenon here, is that they really do not understand why the world thinks that this is worse, that these suicide bombings are worse than killing 15 civilians, but from a plane. They think it's even, this is noble. A person goes and kills himself or herself for the cause. True, it's killing civilians, but it's after, but he's giving up the most precious thing, his or her own life. So this is a noble way of fighting. This is an understanding among people, not necessarily religious. Another thing that I've heard from many people, neighbors and family, that in the last 3 years, all those who went into suicide attacks had been exposed personally to terrible cases of death and killing of civilians by Israeli soldiers. I started to collect such, there are about, I don't know, more than 200 suicide attacks out of about 270 tried and failed. So people, family, neighbors, friends claimed that all of them had witnessed some sort of a terrible death of another. Hanadi, as I said, Hanadi Jaradat witnessed her brother being killed. There is a woman in the Haitian refugee camp. She witnessed a neighbor who was killed in the Haitian refugee camp during an Israeli invasion into Bethlehem. Now, the Haitian refugee camp had a position. They decided not to fight the Israeli tanks. The Fatah leaders of this camp told a few of the armed people in the camp, "You don't dare to shoot from here. It's a lost battle, and we don't want to see the Haitian destroyed." So the Haitian responded to the Israeli invasion with silence. And still, I think 3 or 4 people were killed in their own homes from passing, maybe there were some shots somewhere in distance, but certainly not from these houses. And Ayat Arhas from the Haitian saw 2 children kind of touching the blood of their father or drowning in the blood of their father, an ordinary guy. Another thing, I listened, there was a debate in Ramallah a year ago about how to proceed with the Intifada. And a professor at Birzeit University, woman, she said, we have to strategize, we have to be more attentive to the world's opinion, we have to be clever. She didn't use moral arguments. She said, we are allowed to use armed struggle against occupation forces in the occupied territories, which means both settlers, settler civilians, and soldiers. The Palestinians do not see settlers as civilians. And then a young student of hers got up and she said, I'm sorry, but I don't see that your way has brought us to anything. What has it given us? For the first 4 or 5 months of this intifada, especially Fatah people and others and other gunmen tried this way of armed shooting, and this is after a phase of I wouldn't say non-violent, because okay, it was throwing stones, but throwing stones at military vehicles and soldiers, but there was a phase of mass resistance, and then a phase of armed resistance, but against Israeli forces and against Israelis in the occupied territories, and it brought nothing, only more bloodshed on the Palestinian side. So what can you offer us? This is another thing said by Palestinians. Another thing said by Palestinians, and I heard this from an activist in the first Intifada, a real hero of the first Intifada, and he said, yes, you have this supreme technology, military technology, that sees somebody at night and can shoot a missile at somebody at night. So what we have is only a bunch of nails and some nitroglycerin, or I don't know what they call it, and all kind of chemical materials that you find in agricultural stuff, in agricultural chemicals. And if we had planes and missiles, we would have used it for sure. I don't think that he knows that he echoed Franz Fanon. But he said it, and this is the general understanding. People are stupefied, and I share this, because this Israeli amazing technological superiority, which can tell if there is a child shaking the fence now and the gate in the fence between the lens and between his village and his school, so they can tell if it's a child, so that they can come and open the door, the gate, maybe 2 hours later, or they can tell if it is somebody who tries to infiltrate. They have such amazing technology that we cannot even know about all of it. So all the Palestinians feel that they are subject to this omnipotence of amazing technology, not only Israeli but American. And they are, what they have is some kilograms of nails and other things and explosives, homemade explosives.
You heard the first half of an hour-long talk on suicide bombers by the Israeli writer and journalist Amira Haas. In part two of this program, Amira Haas gives a courageous and very detailed report on the Palestinian organizations that play a role in the suicide bombings: Hamas, the Islamic Jihad, the Popular Front, and Fatah. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Amira Haas on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of the complete talk by Amira Haas on suicide bombers by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone, or on the web. Our toll-free phone number, 877-TUC-TAPE, translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call. TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. Amira Haas, thoughts about suicide bombers and their families. Amira Haas is the only Jewish-Israeli correspondent on Palestinian affairs who's living among the people she reports on. For the last 10 years, she has lived in the Gaza Strip and now in Ramallah in the occupied West Bank. She writes for the large daily newspaper, Haaretz. Her integrity and careful reporting have brought her a huge international audience. She also has seriously antagonized both the Israeli and even the Palestinian leadership by her criticism of their actions and strategies. Her report on suicide bombers in the first part of her talk was intensely personal, based on direct contact with families and friends. Some of them are her neighbors. Now she describes the external circumstances that lead youngsters to take this terrible step, the feeling of utter powerlessness, anger, and despair after decades of brutal occupation. Here is Amira Haas.
What I've observed during these years is indeed that there is this collective and personal sensation or feeling of terrible impotence vis-a-vis Israeli might. Terrible impotence vis-a-vis this global injustice that Israel is inflicting on them, that's how they feel, with policies of colonization, with a policy of no freedom of movement, with a policy of restrictions on use of water, etc., etc., disregarding the fact that the peace negotiations haven't led to peace or independence. And then also a lot of anger that the world is indifferent, a lot of anger that the world pays attention to any suicide attack which causes the death, which kills and murders 15 Jews or 20 Jews or 5 Israelis and Jews, but nobody really pays attention when 3 Palestinians are getting killed today and 3 others tomorrow and 5 others in the coming 3 days, and bit by bit. And one is a child, and one is a man and in his 50s, and one is a shepherd, and one is a farmer, and one is a shopkeeper, and one is this, and one is that, and they're all civilians. But it goes, that's what they feel, it goes unnoticed. They are taking revenge here of all the Palestinian death. And, you know, out of the 2,500 or so Palestinian casualties till today, you know, it's very difficult to exactly measure how many of them were civilians, but I would say no less than 60% were civilians, no less. And many of those who were policemen and were killed were not killed in battle, but they were killed while they were in their positions, posts in the West Bank and Gaza, and they were killed by Israeli soldiers only because they had arms, but they did not initiate any battle. There are about 400 children who were killed. There are about 200 women who were killed. So these people seeing this and making the measurements, and they want revenge, for sure. So the moment, what I have discovered in all my talks, is the moment of omnipotence for these people. One moment of omnipotence. It's an illusion, of course. One moment of omnipotence which pays back to this long history and long future which is awaiting them of impotence. Now, they all have participated in funerals of others who have died, were killed or killed themselves and killed others. So they can imagine how their own funeral would look like. So, you know, it's like the children who are angry with their parents and they go up and they say, I wish I died and then I will see my parents now sorry for my death. So they can really portray their own funeral and they can really feel how people will miss them and love them and cherish them and see them as heroes. They can do it because they've participated in so many funerals, as one of them, as one of the people told me at the beginning of the Intifada. Once stopped knowing in whose funeral you are, maybe it's your own funeral. There are so many funerals every day. Another way of me to get very close to this issue of to these suicide bombers or would-be was through 3 interviews smuggled to me out of prison, out of Israeli prison. They were done by an Israeli-Palestinian prisoner who had been already for 18 years in jail. He was involved with the Palestinian Popular Front some 20 years ago and was caught and sentenced to life, even though he claims he was not involved in what he was charged with. But he met several youngsters from the northern West Bank who failed in their attempt to commit suicide. They were caught beforehand. And he wanted to understand this phenomenon because he had not known it about Palestinian society. He knew that then when they were fighting 15 years ago, they were fighting for life, not for death. He didn't understand this phenomenon when these youngsters, 19 years old, who yesterday was supposed to be Shahid, now is complaining that at the shop of the jail, he could not find gel to his hair. So that tragic, he said, there is something, I don't understand this. So he started to interview them, three of them, and he also wanted to penetrate through the slogans they were already disseminating because they were already adopted by their groups in jail, and then when you are adopted, you start to give, to recite the version, the official version of the group. Yes, I go because of heaven and because of God and because of this. And one guy that in the official, more or less official interview, kept telling him that he was doing this for religious reasons, this one guy had the daily stroll with him one day in the courtyard of jail, of prison, and he told him, you know, and this guy could have been, this prisoner could have been their father. So he told him, you know, the first time that Jenin camp was invaded by the Israeli army and there was curfew, nobody could leave the house for 3 days. Then I looked up from the window and I saw a dog going out from one of the houses and passing by the soldiers, and nothing happened to the dog. So that's when I decided to go and commit suicide, because if the life of a dog worth more than our life, then what should I do? But this, he told him, this simple story of a dog. But still, I think that it will be incorrect to say, to dismiss completely the religious aspect of it. In 96 and 94 suicide attacks, mostly perpetrated by Hamas people, certainly, and this is also what some of these interviewees said, the ideological religious element was very strong. The belief that heaven is waiting and that there is that while what you are doing, you are helping in liberating Palestine. No real, there was a great belief in this. Now it's much less. Now it's the people who are being recruited are much less motivated by this religious ideology. But still, most of them, as I've learned, in the few months or weeks before the attack, are becoming very, very observant. They go 5 times to the mosque. They pray. They try to behave better. If they drank before, they stop drinking alcohol. They try to be more polite with their parents. This I've learned from several cases. Now, this is also a reason for the family to be very fearful. If they see that their child is becoming more observant, I meant mostly about going to mosque and becoming very, very orthodox, if I can use this term here, then it might be a sign that he has decided to commit suicide. The Palestinian security organizations have received during the last 2 years or so several warnings by families that suspected their children are going to commit suicide. Right now, they are in Jericho prison, 4 youngsters from Jenin area who are arrested because of information given by their family. The family preferred them to be arrested than to commit suicide. I was told by a Palestinian security officer that he himself, a year ago, was told, or some month ago, by families in the Nablus area that they know that there are 4 women students, very successful women students, who decided to commit suicide. He found them, he located them in a flat somewhere near Jerusalem. He had the hard work at convincing them or dissuading them. They had everything prepared. They wanted to go with Hamas. Hamas didn't want. They went with Jihad or Fatah. Now I don't remember. But he managed to dissuade them. So This is in as contrast to the general belief that Palestinian families are happy with their children going to heaven in such a way. This is all true on the personal and family level. This explaining on the background of occupation, not only the immediate occupation of today and of the need to revenge for a chain of civilians getting killed by Israeli soldiers, of endless Israeli assaults, etc. But all this accumulation of the last 36 years of Israeli occupation, which have made Palestinians lose all belief in a possible future, decent future for themselves and for their community and for their children. This is good for us to understand the personal motivations, I think, to understand of individuals. But there is here another dimension, a dimension of organizations, and the organizations which send those people. And this will be the last part of my talk before we start the questions. Now, Hamas were the first ones to use, in this intifada, to use suicide bombers. Then Jihad followed suit. Then Popular Front, Secular Popular Front, sent someone who killed himself and maybe wounded two or three soldiers in Gaza Strip. And this was after the head of the Popular Front was assassinated by Israel. And then Fatah started to launch their live bombs after a leader of Shuhada al-Aqsa was assassinated in November 2001. This organization certainly find it very easy to recruit suicide bombers. If I said before that one needs only 5 minutes in order to find to convince someone to commit suicide, I think that very often there are so many candidates for suicide bombings that some activists of some organizations had to send them away and to say no. And I have read some affidavits of youngsters who wanted to commit suicide. They met the person in charge in their camp or whatever who refused because of their young age. And I've seen some other affidavits that young children were recruited very easily by very careless, irresponsible mobilizers in this neighborhood. Now the question is, how come all these organizations are using this weapon? And how come they have not used it from the start of the Intifada? I think that for the Islamic Jihad, which is a very small organization, by the way, when it was established as part of the Islamic Brothers in the early 80s, they made it clear that their target should be only soldiers and no civilians. I think that they opt for some sort of chaos. Because they are so small, they don't have any responsibility for a mass population. So they don't have a real huge constituency. Their real constituency is, I guess, some international Islamic, radical Islamic group. Some say Iran. I don't know. But they certainly build, in their ideology, build on creating chaos in the area. Chaos which will bring to the end of Israel. And this I say from based on talks that I've led with activists of Islamic Jihad before some years and some readings. Now with Hamas is more complicated. Hamas, of course, at the end believed that Palestine would be a Muslim state from the sea to the river. Maybe Jews would be allowed to stay there, maybe not, I don't know, but eventually this will happen. Now I'm sorry some of you have heard me saying this vitz, but the difference between moderates and extremist Hamas people is that the extremists think this can happen, this Islamic Palestinian state can happen in 50 years. The moderates think it will happen in 500 years. Now, the number of moderates has decreased during the last 3 years. And I think that more people believe that if you create this chaos, you bring this solution or whatever you call it faster. This is one way to understand it. Another way to understand it is that Hamas, as a political power which represents a big chunk of Palestinian society, is always very attendant to people's moods. And they have read at a certain moment that Palestinians are fed up with this imbalance of victims in this intifada. Now, the beginning of this intifada was seen as a victory, actually, or of the PLO organizations taking the premiership, if I can call this so, in the struggle for liberation. After, for years, PLO and especially Fatah were taken as just a backbone and a poodle of the Palestinian Authority. And all of a sudden, with this intifada, which started by some activists, young activists of Fatah, Fatah was seen again as, okay, we are leading the struggle for real independence, not anybody else. In a strange way, people were counting the number of victims who belong to each organization. And the victims who belong to each organization means those who went to the checkpoints and were throwing stones at Israeli military vehicles or Israeli soldiers. So Fatah was the winning party here. Then Hamas, at the beginning of this intifada, Hamas was very suspicious with Fatah and Arafat's motives. They believed that this was only a bargaining chip on the part of that what Arafat was opting for is better cards in his negotiation with Israel. They didn't believe it was, they believed like Israel, it was all orchestrated by Arafat. But then they saw that the public, general public, was shifting again and supporting more Fatah because it was leading the struggle against Israeli occupation. At the same time, people saw that this leadership of Hamas was leading nowhere, was bringing them nowhere, that all these victims led nowhere, that Israeli opinion, public opinion, hasn't changed, hasn't come to see Israeli occupation as they hoped they would see. On the contrary, Israeli population, Israeli public, saw the intifada as a terrible offense and a terrible insult after the great years of peace, of Oslo. That's how the Israelis saw it. So Hamas, it was very attentive to the people's mood, felt the people's need in revenge. And they responded to this need. So they were not thinking about the strategy of independence and liberation. They were thinking about how to improve their position within the Palestinian internal, political internal arena. This is a long, I think, long, old characteristics of Palestinian political scene, that every Palestinian organization has adopted tactics vis-à-vis Israel since the 60s or 70s, not after carefully calculating what is really bringing them closer to liberation, but how it will improve the popularity, the internal popularity within the Palestinian population. This is not something I've invented. I've learned it from Palestinian colleagues and Palestinian observers. I must stress this. And then, of course, I forgot, then when Hamas started, then Fatah felt they are losing this competition, and they started to adopt this method as well. Out of impotence, out of weakness, everything, but aiming to improve their internal position. And I heard it. I had this argument, sort of, with one Fatah leader. And I said, how can you call this war of liberation when you send a youngster to kill people in a restaurant or whatever it was? And he said, what, we have to prove to the people that we can also have revenge for our dead. So, in a nutshell, Palestinian organizations have used, abused, consumed the need of so many youngsters, Palestinian youngsters and individuals, their need in revenge, the society's need in revenge, these youngsters' readiness to kill themselves out of collective despair, not necessarily personal despair, So they have been using it out of their own impotence of those organizations and lack of unified strategy. I think it is letting the Palestinian leadership of the Oslo years to get away with their responsibility of cooperating or collaborating too long with this deception of a peace process. I think there were margins of maneuver of the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian leaderships and organizations during the last 10 years. Enough margins of nothing is deterministic in history. I don't believe. I mean, there are people have still, and organizations still have the power to change some things, even when they are facing terribly mighty powers. And I think in those years, if they had been more attentive to the people, if they were not so entrenched in old habits of hierarchy within the Palestinian society and in safeguarding their privileged positions, if they were very insistent on the issue of settlements, they would have been able to get much more than allowing these suicide bombers, youngsters, who had been neglected. It's youngsters who had been neglected by the Palestinian Authority during the years of Oslo. Look, the fact is that the number of Israeli settlers has increased during the last 3 years. Many have not been deterred by the present situation and the clashes. The suicide attacks inside Israel have completely blurred the difference between settlers and Israelis in Israel. So it motivated the Israeli army to permanently improve the methods and means of safeguarding settler security. So the fence in many places is built in order to secure to guarantee their security. There are fences around the settlements. There are special rules of engagement that allow the army to shoot at any person nearing any settlement. So in a way, the last 3 years have seen an improvement in the logistics of defense of Israeli settlements. And this is why many settlers feel very encouraged to go and live there. A different Palestinian strategy during the years of Oslo, I think, could have rallied many more Israelis or made many more Israelis understand the reality that the Israeli government was trying to impose. The main weapon in Israeli hands during the years of Oslo was the alienation of Palestinian leadership from its own people. That's how I see it. Israel, in the disguise of a peace process, continued the occupation and the colonization. But the Palestinian leadership cooperated with this. Now, I don't say that this is the reason why it continued. You know, when they could pay decent salaries to teachers, but not invest so much money in economical monopolies, which were benefiting only a few people of the Palestinian Authority, I think they would have had the people with them. And then at the same time, if they stopped negotiations with Israel and said, we don't negotiate as long as you have another house built in the occupied territories, they would have drawn the attention of the world. But they continued. But they really continued all the time to speak up with Israelis and getting their privileges to go around. So, believe me, I know there has been an Israeli clear plan to bring into a Palestinian surrender. There was the plan. The plan has not changed. But still there was... The Palestinians did not come in 1993 only as defeated. They also came in a time in a world which was backing the idea of a two-state solution, an end of occupation. Now I say there is a problem. I mean, I think that the problem with the European collaboration with this myth of Oslo was very disastrous. I'm not mentioning American. You know, I think that we don't do justice to Palestinians if we only think of them in terms of victims and victimologies and do not believe that they have power in their hands to change. I think it is wrong about any people in struggle against oppression and also about Palestinians. Because what there is multiplicity of strategies, if it's not an oxymoron. Because when you have multiplicity of strategies, it means that there is no one leadership that is learning what is best in the struggle for independence. Thank you.
You heard the conclusion of a one-hour talk by the Israeli journalist and author Amira Haas. Amira Haas was born in Israel as the daughter of Holocaust survivors. She is fearless in her daily life in the city of Ramallah under Israeli occupation and unafraid to criticize the Palestinian Authority or the Israeli government. Amira Haas wrote two books about her 10-year residence in occupied Palestine. Reporting from Ramallah, an Israeli journalist in an occupied land, and Drinking the Sea at Gaza, Days and Nights in a Land Under Siege. She spoke at the University of California, Berkeley in October 2003 about suicide bombers and their families. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on Amira Haas on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under newest programs. You can get information how to order a copy of the complete talk by Amira Haas on suicide bombers by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. My name is Moriah Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.